Hey, George, welcome. I really appreciate you taking the time today to sit down with me and talk about your case. I just want to remind everybody that your case in particular has more punchlines to it, I think, than any of the January 6 cases that I have personally looked at. I think it has more evidence of the weaponization of the Department of Justice against the average American than any of the other cases that I've looked at up to this point. And it's one of the reasons why, after you reached out to me, that I was really anxious to get to this as quickly as I possibly could. So I actually backburnered a couple of other stories that I'm working on in order to bump you up to the front of the pile here. I really think it's that important. But before I start the process of engaging you directly and asking you some questions, I just want to give everybody a brief overview. And you can correct me on some of the details as we go along, if in fact I get some of this not exactly correct here in this little bit of an intro here. But the bottom line is you went to the Capitol on January 6th. We know that. The other thing that I know from your story is that you were arrested in March of 2021. You were swatted by multiple agencies that day, including the Capitol Police, which is a really rare occurrence. I don't even know if it's happened with anybody else. It's certainly not happened to anybody else that I'm aware of. Maybe it was your co-defendant in the case, which we'll talk about at some length here as well. Maybe the Capitol Police were involved in his arrest as well. But the unusual nature of that, obviously, is that you live in West Virginia, and so that's kind of out of their jurisdiction, to say the least. The reason for that is, for all intents and purposes, you were an accused cop killer. You were named as being responsible for the death of Officer Brian Sicknick, the only officer who died allegedly as a result of the events on January 6th. But it seems like in the timeline that by the time you were arrested, we already knew from the coroner that Sicknick had died of natural causes the next day. So there's a punchline right there. And when you skip forward a little bit further, you were immediately charged with 10 felonies, and which not only is it modus operandi for the Department of Justice to ridiculously overcharge defendants anyway, most of them with the intent of getting a quick plea deal out of them, but that wasn't really their intention with you. They intended to make an example out of you as the quote-unquote cop killer. And then in addition to that, they basically threw you behind bars for about 5.5 months, I think, as the story goes. And then the next big punchline was, is you had a victory. Your attorneys were able to successfully secure for you an appellate court ruling in which, in a 3-0 decision by a DC appellate court, they, I'll just say it, they bitch slapped your Judge Hogan, into letting you go and basically telling him that he had violated your civil rights in your bond hearings by denying you bond hearings. And so they did let you go. You were then put on home confinement for, gosh, several months after that. We'll touch on that story a little bit as we go on. And then as your legal process continued, eventually your charges were dropped from, actually all 10 felony charges were dropped against you. And then they left two misdemeanor charges in play. And those two misdemeanor charges were, I think, basically the basic trespassing charge and some sort of a disorderly conduct charge, to whatever extent that was. So by the time you got to your sentencing hearing, another punchline happened. And that punchline is that you have, along with your co-defendant, been named in a civil lawsuit that has been brought by the Sicknick family. They're suing you for $10 million for basically wrongful death in his situation. And the other punchline to that is that the other named co-defendant in this civil suit is President Donald Trump, former President Trump. And that's absurd enough on its face, and we'll get into the why this is absurd. But I think, and this is what I want to just throw out here at the beginning, and then we'll get to it later in detail, is I think that the reason why that you have been named in this suit is that this is retribution from the Department of Justice. I don't believe that this is coming directly from the Sicknick family, because as we're going to talk about, the evidence in your case, the evidence in your trial is so clear that you had no part in Brian Sicknick's death. You certainly were nowhere near him. I've seen the videos now. At the moment where he was allegedly hit by bear spray, pepper spray, whatever the case may be, which supposedly triggered maybe something in his body physically that was laying dormant and waiting to be activated that led to his death and a stroke the next day or a series of strokes. You weren't anywhere in the vicinity at all. And the fact that they would bring this on you, I think, is just punishment because you managed to secure a victory unlike any other J6 defendant up to this point, in that you won an appellate court decision, which, as I said earlier, embarrassed the judge and embarrassed the DOJ for the absurdity and the ridiculousness of the charges against you and the fact that they were holding you in prison for 5.5 months. So there we go. That's I haven't even hit all of the punchlines yet. We're going to get to some of the, there's more coming in this discussion that we're going to have. So, George, I really, as I said, I really appreciate you taking the time with me, and we're going to get this story out there for you. So let's start from the beginning. Tell me why you decided to go to January 6th, because you're a business owner, you're busy, you run multiple restaurants, you work 100 hours a week, and yet you felt it was necessary to take your time off and go to DC.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak here, Steve. I've been a huge fan of yours, and I appreciate this this microphone to get my story out. You know, I went there that day. I was planning on going that day with a group of men here from town, several friends, avid Trump supporters. The way I looked at it was like the last Trump event that there could be, possibly. I had never been to a Trump event. I'm an avid supporter. I've been a fan of his, you know, long before he ran for president. I grew up in his casinos. I tell everybody that story because my father took me to Atlantic City as a kid. I used to play at Trump Taj Mahal and Trump World. So, you know, as a business owner, when he ran, I wanted an outsider businessman. I think the country should be run as a business, per se. So I was a fan of his. But that day, you know, everybody backed out. There was supposed to be a group of us. They all backed out. And then last minute, I spoke with my co-defendant, Julian Cater. He said he'd pick me up. My wife said, go. You never get a chance to do something like this. What's the worst that can happen? You know, because we were worried. You know, the other guys that backed out, we were worried about being attacked that day. So with her giving me the blessing to go, my staff was like, yeah, you should go. They knew I was a Trump supporter. I had Trump signs in my restaurant. It was a Tuesday, Wednesday. And I said, let's go. And Julian said he picked me up. So to me, it was like, you know, I like spontaneous events like that. Mm-hmm. And we went to take some protection with us. I stopped at the gun store that I shop at, and I bought some pepper spray and some bear spray to take as a deterrent, or, you know, as a self-defense mechanism in case we got into some trouble later on that evening, based on what I had seen on TV. Trump supporters were attacked after events like that. So I wasn't going to let that happen to me, though. The one time I get out of work, I didn't want to get, you know, beat up or jumped in the street. So,
and I want to interject right here so that people can understand this. And, you know, I don't know how many people from the other side of the political, you know, philosophies that are going to watch this particular podcast, but they have to understand that, yes, this was a real and present possibility danger, because in the previous rallies that had taken place, and there had been others since the election in DC, and of course, going back to the summer of 2020, there were many violent riots in Washington, DC, and there were attacks by Antifa and other groups against whether they're Trump supporters or more, for lack of a better way of putting them, conservative activist groups, that sort of thing, all the way up to, you know, if you'll recall, Rand Paul and his wife were attacked and threatened. Their lives were literally in danger just walking out of a meeting at a hotel there. And so I was very well aware of this. Also, we were attuned to it. In fact, we were anticipating, when I say we, myself and another journalist that I was in DC with, we were well aware of the fact that if we stayed after the rally and after the event, that's typically when those dangers present themselves. And I didn't bring anything with me like you did, but many, many, many people, average, normal, law abiding, never have committed a crime in their life, never been guilty of an assault charge, have never used a weapon against anybody in their life, took some sort of legal protection with them. Obviously, you can't carry a firearm into the district, but you can legally take pepper spray and some other types of defensive items. So I just wanted to get that out there so that everybody understands that. That's why you stopped.
Yeah.
You did a sensible thing.
Well, I knew the time frame of the event, and I saw that the roads were blocked off, and each block is, you know, a quarter mile to, you know, so the distance. So just based on what I'd seen, you know, once you go walking back to your car to catch an Uber, we were catching a Lyft to and from. So we had a really nice, you know, I don't want to say strategy, but to get to the event, get it over with, and then come back home. You know, A lot of people said, why did you go if you knew there was going to be danger? It's the Capitol, the United States Capitol. You know, it's a Trump event. I shouldn't be fearful to go show my support for the active president. And that right there alone was very, like, you know, more of a reason to go to say, listen, I'm not afraid to support a certain individual, you know, whether he's right or wrong. That's just not American, you know. And
let's go straight to the day. One of the interesting things that I've observed in your evidence and in your own videos is that you did not arrive at the Capitol building or the Capitol area until well after the rioting was already taking place and the violence had already been taking place for some time. The video I saw you walking down the sidewalk was about 1:33, and you weren't even close to the Capitol yet. What time did you actually get on the Capitol grounds?
We got there maybe around 2 o'clock, maybe.
So you stayed for the entire speech at the
election. We stayed until about the end, and we started walking, and we tried to find something to eat. We were hungry.
Okay.
Found some food trucks all the way on the, I guess, the east side of the Capitol. We ate. The food really sucked. I'm a restaurateur, so I like to try, you know, different stuff, and especially like from the food trucks.
Right.
So we ordered the thing that stuck in my head was we ordered these cheesesteaks, and it took forever, and they were really terrible, like subpar, like very subpar. And I was like still hungry, you know, because I like to eat. Or at the time, I like to eat. You know, I was a little, you know, I love food, so I wanted to order another one, and it always stuck in my head. Like, man, if I had just ordered another one, we would have, you know, two steps off, because, you know, at the end of the day, we were at the wrong place at the right time, you know, for the situation. So we just walked over nonchalantly and had no idea what was going on. And we just walked up there and things started popping off, you know, from a distance. I didn't see anything go on. It felt like we had just walked up and the officers just started spraying and the crowd was worked up. And I didn't understand what was happening 2 hours prior because there was no service. So
Let's give another point of clarification here for those who don't know. I'll do this as quickly as possible. I'm assuming that when you say that you arrived about 2 o'clock, that you were now on the west side, because that's where the battle line was really going on. Nothing was really happening on the east side at this point, or it was just
all the way on the west side.
Okay.
The farthest west you can go, that's where I was.
All right. So you're on the west side, and it's imperative that people understand, especially even down to this minor misdemeanor charge of trespassing. I call it the glorified trespassing charge. They don't call it that. You know, you're illegally on, you know, government property at the wrong place, the wrong time, that sort of thing. But the bottom line is that even when I arrived, I arrived at the Reflection Pool, the Peace Monument area, at exactly about 1:10, because I left the speech early to get ahead of the crowd. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got there, there wasn't a single whiff of a barricade. There wasn't a sign. There was no possible way for anybody, even at the time that I arrived, which was only 20 minutes after that initial West Side barricade breach, you know, the famous Ray Epps scene. Those barricades had been removed. They had been hidden. The restricted area signs, the do not enter signs, the closed area signs had been turned over. They had been pushed under bushes. They were gone at this point. Yeah. And so you're arriving now almost an hour after I am. There's not a chance that you could possibly know you were entering a restricted space. And this is in and of itself one of the most vile characteristics of this Department of Justice weaponization against peaceful protesters. And when I say peaceful protesters, you saw how many people were there that day. Hundreds of thousands of people. And as of yet, and this number's not going to grow much larger, by the time they finish arresting people for actual violent acts or accusations of violent acts, like you're in your case, they're only going to have between 300 and 400 people that they're actually going to be able to identify as having done violence or having done property damage out of hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Those 300 people created a narrative and entrapped all of us as a result of this. The Department of Justice knows this. The FBI knows this. Merrick Garland himself knows this. Every single judge litigating every single case knows that you, me, and tens of thousands of other people that arrived at that Capitol had zero idea or knowledge that we were entering a restricted space. And not only were the fences, the bike racks, and the signs removed, but there were no police.
Yeah.
They had all been retreated and had retreated up to the Capitol.
I didn't see a single officer.
No.
I didn't see a single, I didn't hear anyone say, please disperse the crowd. I didn't hear anyone. At the end, they said curfew came out and everyone left, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, when we walked up and it was like, you know, from a distance, when you saw the bleachers and up there and, you know, where the inauguration took place or takes place, it was like begging for people to like go up there because it was like the perfect setting for,
yeah, of course,
you know, whatever thing. So you could see people were like, you know, not, I mean, I couldn't see it from up close because I didn't come anywhere near the bike racks.
Yeah.
But that's how close it was. It was within 50 feet, not even at that point, you know, from the bike racks to that stand area. Yeah, when everybody started climbing that from a distance, I walked the opposite direction. One, I'm kind of afraid of heights, you know, especially when there's hundreds of people climbing that. I care about my business way too much to go put myself in jeopardy like that. I actually did end up like twisting my ankle walking that day. I was so pissed because I went back to work and I'm on my feet all day running this restaurant. You know, this isn't just some Joe Schmo restaurant. This is a high volume customer satisfaction, $15, $18 sandwich. Points I had a staff of 15, 16, 20 people sometimes running. Thank God, you know, I had a really good product and a really good customer base. Yeah, so I was no way going to put myself in jeopardy like that. So,
and even your co-defendant in his interviews attested to that as well and said that you were much more level-headed than he is and you were more cautious. And that was on the record early as well, right? When did you make those statements?
I was within an hour of being arrested.
Well, there you go.
You know, I guess he got arrested a couple hours before me, but I guess the two people that turned me in to the feds had another story. And one of them was a former business partner who's got his own issues in life, but he wants to put them all on me. You know, he's a clown. And then the other kid I fired, he worked for me for like 2 months. I fired him. He was upset. So he went to the feds and told them that I was a hothead and crazy, this and that. Well, you know, if you were in my shoes running a business till 4 a.m, with, you know, the after party, I was literally like the lifeblood of Morgantown, the late night scene. So, you know, we're doing high volume and there's no time, you know, we're dealing with a lot of drunk people and inebriated. So you have to keep them in line. That's why they call me the sandwich Nazi, you know, over the years. I think I brought that up. They used to call me the sandwich Nazi and it went viral a couple of times simply because it was no BS business. You know, you wait in line, you order what you want. You've got a few questions, we'll answer them. But once they taste that sandwich, they always came back. And they always knew what to do, you know. And when you're busy till 4 a.m. and you're cranking out volume, you know, you can't be you got to be tough a little bit. So
I get it, totally understand. But the bottom line is you did get ratted out for just being there that day, as so many others have been. That some people have been ratted out by their church members, their classmates, their family members, people they work with. It's amazing how many people in America now are willing to turn on their neighbors and turn on their coworkers and such. But nevertheless, it's what happened to you. So let's just jump to the big day. Did you get any pre-announcement? Did anybody call you? Did the FBI call you or did they just show up at your door?
Just showed up at my door.
And what time of day did they come?
About like 9:30 at night.
Oh, so they did a nighttime raid on you rather than
about 9:30 at night. Kids were asleep. One of them was up. They storming out, you know, banging on my door. Dogs are going crazy. My fiance was like, what's going on? She opened the door first. They pulled her out. And I came out, put your hands up. I was in a robe, actually. I was about to take a shower, so I felt like Tony Soprano. I was standing outside in the cold, you know. I'm like, what is going on here? And I can see the lights flashing, you know. My neighbors my son's looking at me. He's like, what is going on here? I'm like, you know, really the only thing that came out of my mouth is, where's the warrant? What's going on here? And I got no response. The warrant's being printed, something along those lines. I told my girl, I said, call my attorney. They sent me off to jail, and that was it. Those are the only three words I've ever said to the feds or anybody of any type of law enforcement since that day.
That was the only thing you ever said right there. And did they ever show you the warrant?
No, I never saw a warrant.
You never saw a warrant. So the first violation of your civil rights, your constitutional rights, is that upon your arrest and when you asked for a warrant, they told you it was being printed out, but they did not present that to you.
Right, nothing.
All right. Now let's continue on with the day or the moment of the arrest, because there's another punchline involved in here. As I set up early in this interview, I said that the Capitol Police were also there. Can you identify how many other agencies other than the FBI, who else was involved and how many?
I believe the Marshals were there, maybe some Morgantown Police. Mm-hmm. But you know, I got pulled out of the house pretty quickly. I wasn't here more than 10 minutes. I mean, by the time all that happened, they dragged me out, but,
did they keep you in your robe or let you put some clothes on?
They grabbed my girl got some clothes for me. I put my clothes on. You know, they asked me if I wanted to talk. I said, talk about what? What are you here for? What's the word? You know, where's the warrant? Amanda, call my attorney. This is crazy. I can't believe this. And, you know, maybe I threw out a Joe Biden comment. You know, this is what Joe Biden's doing to speak, you know, Americans now. Because I knew it had to have been for that, like being there that day. But I'm thinking to myself, like, the worst thing I possibly could have did was trespass, you know, or at least in that vicinity, because I had no idea an incident happened that day.
Yeah.
But they introduced themselves to my fiance as Capitol Police, FBI, and three women were here speaking to her. They spoke to her for 3 hours. So she went and started talking. Rule number one, never talk to the feds. I mean, that's just based on movies or TV.
Yeah. Well, let me set you up here, because one of those women is just an insanely fascinating and surprising aspect of your story, because one of these women was, in fact, the acting chief of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman. Is that correct?
Based on my wife's recollection from seeing her, yes, it was her. She introduced herself as a Capitol Police officer. I don't think she said her name. I don't know if she remembers her name, but you know, after 3 hours of being interrogated near the middle of the night, we actually did a lineup yesterday with the photos of her and, you know, different haircuts. She's like, yeah, I think that's her. I'm pretty sure.
And at the time, you didn't know why the Capitol Police would be there, because you had no idea, because you hadn't seen a warrant and they hadn't told you what you were being charged with. You had no idea that basically they were there in such force. And the reason why representatives of the Capitol Police Department were there was because you were in fact the cop killer, right?
Yeah, I had no clue. No idea. An incident happened that day. It was never mentioned to me, nor would I ever think that an incident like that would happen, because we didn't go there to fight police officers or fight anyone, really.
So take me through a lightning round here real quick, because the next thing I think that was a huge violation of your civil liberties was the fact that you did not get access to an attorney for 6 days. Is that right?
It was a couple of days. Yeah. Before that, I had to file that I needed a public defender. I'm not sure exactly how many days it was, but it was close to that 4 to 5 period. By the time I was, you know, sitting in jail, even my fiance had no idea what was happening. It took her, I guess, till the next morning, the news started coming out that we were arrested and as to why, because they didn't explain.
You were sitting in a Morgantown jail at this point, right?
I was sitting in West Virginia's North Central Regional, which is like an hour and a half from here.
Okay. And the reason why you needed a public defender was because obviously a charge was coming from D.C. So your local attorney would not have been able to handle that, I assume.
That's true. Yeah. But I couldn't afford an attorney. I mean, there was no way I could shell out that type of money.
Yeah. So you had to wait several days in order to finally get connected with an attorney. And then you were transferred to the D.C. gulag. Is that right?
I had my first bond hearing. Within mm-hmm. that week, I was trying to find the exact date. I couldn't find it, but it was like within a week of that, we found a local court-appointed attorney, took the case, went to bond. I'm like, okay, I'm going home. Like in my heart and my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm going home. There's no way they're going to keep me. I'll figure this out later. Take me over to the court proceeding, and we got my bond was denied.
Now, when did you first find out that you were being charged with 10 felonies?
I think it was the first time I met my attorney.
Okay.
So it was in that 5 or 6 day period.
So you sat in jail for days just thinking, I'm sitting in jail. I can't go to work. I can't run my business because I trespassed.
Completely shut down. The restaurant was shut down. My fiance didn't even tell me over the phone. I think that's where she knew what happened the next morning. And she's like, I'm not going to tell you anything. It's all over the news. I'm like, what is going on here? You know, then they threw me in solitary. They pulled me. They called me over. I was like dead man walking, you know, handcuffed, chained, walking me through the hallways or clearing the hallways out for me. And I'm like, this is bizarre. Like, what is going on here? And then they threw me in solitary confinement. The first two nights I was in there with like the trunk pod, you know, the boss at the jail, the warden was like, listen, man, you're all over the news. We're going to throw you in solitary confinement for your protection. Okay. Well, I didn't know what was going on. Well, when she told me, my attorneys came in, she explained to me, you know, there's an officer that died that day. And I almost had a heart attack. I was cuffed. I begged them to take the cuffs off because I felt like my heart was just no clue what happened. And I felt like I was in a movie, you know, from day one, from this first second they stormed my house. And it still seems a little surreal, but bond denied. 3 weeks later, they shipped me off to DC. And I was a little nervous about that because I wasn't unsure what to expect.
Okay, from the legal, so from your legal process, you were now in DC. You got your lawyer, and in addition to that, this was where I think you had a tremendous stroke of luck compared to so many other January 6th defendants who have needed court-appointed attorneys. You got a good one.
I got good ones. They were phenomenal. They Beth Gross, Richard Walker from here from West Virginia. What was funny was I was sitting in my pod in my cell, solitary confinement, and some guy came knocking on my window, you know, on the outside, and it's like, you know, frosted window, and the guy knocks, hey, yo, Sandwich Nazi, you in there? George, you in there? And I'm like, oh, man, how does this guy know who I am? You know, and I guess I was all over the news. He's like, hey man, what's going on? You got to hang in there. You need coffee and all that. I'm like, you know, like, why would I need coffee? I'm sitting in this cell all day, you know, how's he going to get me coffee? But then he's like, hey man, who's your coin of, you know, who's your attorneys? And I said, I got Beth Gross and Richard Walker. And I threw their names out. Oh, they're going to fight for you, man. They're going to fight for you. And I just took it as a sign from God. Like, because, you know, we had several attorneys reach out to my family to represent, and they want this money, like big profile attorneys.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, one, I can't afford them. And two, I was confident in the case and in the facts of the case that I had nothing to do with the incident, you know, and I took my shot with them. They proved to me that they were willing to fight for me. And, you know, after that first bond hearing, I said, man, don't worry, this is just round one. And I'm thinking to myself, like, round one, this is nuts. Like, how many rounds are we going here? You know, and
quite a few. You
know, yeah. And, you know, I'd never been jailed before. I'd never been in trouble before. So it was a unique experience. Now, seeing how all that plays out, yeah, there's multiple rounds and multiple gut punches in this type of scenario.
So that was your first. That was your first denial of bond. Second denial, did that take place in front of Hogan? Well, first of all, did the first denial take place in front of Hogan?
No, the first one was here in West Virginia.
Okay, all right. So now you're in DC, and how many more bond hearings did you have there?
We had one more, like a couple months later. I think April, May. I think it was in May actually. And this was, you had mentioned earlier that the medical examiner report had came out. It took 100 days from the 6th for the medical report to come out. So okay. I was in jail for, along with Julian at one point, maybe a month and a half before that report came out.
Okay. All right.
So while we're in jail, everyone's like, the other guys are like, kind of, you know, we're all like kind of laughing at each other. Like, man, look, you're an insurrectionist. You know, you're a white supremacist. Oh, you're a Nazi. And like, you know, we just can't believe the media, how they spun all this for us. So, you know, I was known as the cop killer, and I'm like, dude, you know, every time somebody said that, I'm like, no, don't introduce me as that, because I had no idea. So when that report finally came out, man, it was like a sigh of relief, because the implications of that report coming out otherwise would have tied us into court so much longer. And the joy of everyone in there, like cheering for us, it was really, it was a unique moment. It was a unique day.
So when that report came out, was your second bond hearing after the report or before that report?
I believe it was after that. Yeah.
Okay. And so now you've got the senior judge, Thomas Hogan, is now presiding over your case. That's correct. And so that bond hearing was presented before him. And what was the reason why they denied your bond the second time?
The way he portrayed me was that, I was the planner and I was the master of events that day. You know, he basically said that I was the leader.
You were the leader.
I was Julian's leader. And okay. I couldn't believe he was saying that. And we're sitting there and this is all via Zoom. And I'm just like, man, what is going on here? My attorney's basically only got like two sentences in that hearing. And me and Julian actually got into it. So, now I'm your leader now. You know that you hear what the judge said, I'm your leader. Like, I'm not here to lead anyone, you know. So that's why he denied my bond. He said I was the leader and I had planned this attack. And they painted this picture. They took clips, you know, that 12 words of hold on, not yet. As me saying, we have this plan already in place. They took, the DOJ put this story together that mm-hmm. I went to a gun shop and I was planning this attack. And I was so mad that, you know, Trump lost. And it was just so bizarre. Like, man, it was just like another... It's a day off, you know?
Yeah, whereas all of us that were there that day were anticipating that Antifa was coming out at night. Right. That's what the rumor on the street was right. that they would be out after dark, as they usually do. And that, of course, there was no anticipation or when we all arrived in D.C. that there would even be a curfew, which ultimately was called right. implemented at 6 p.m. on the 6th by the mayor. And so everybody thought that Antifa would be out at night. In fact, I did something similar to what you did, except I did it later after I got out of the Capitol and did the things that I did in terms of the videos that I captured, some interviews that I took place in. I went and found some food and a place to use the restroom. And then after I did that, I made it back to the Capitol right at dusk because I planned on being there when the bad, you know, even more bad stuff, let's say, was supposed right. to happen from.
Yeah, we were halfway back to the car by then.
I came back around 5 o'clock. And you know, I don't know, get in trouble for this. I'm certainly on the record for it, but I deliberately violated the curfew because I expected that Antifa wouldn't care about the curfew. And if that they were going to come out and attack any remaining elements of Trump supporters in the area, that's right. when it was going to happen. And I was going to capture that on video as the best of my ability. But as it turned out, they weren't there. They did not show up. By then, the National Guard and overwhelming police presence from every agency in the region was there. And they were now building the perimeter around the Capitol. And so I'm sure that those pussy boys went home if they were even thinking about it. They did not show up.
Well,
but again, the point being is that your statement of, you know, not yet, whatever, is like, you know, this is not why we brought this, you know, bear spray with us, because we're not being attacked by anybody.
Right. Well, what had happened is when we walked up, officers were spraying. We walked up and I quickly retreated and I lost my co-defendant. And within that period, learning later, the officer had sprayed him to some extent, was spraying the crowd, not directly spraying him at that moment. About 9 minutes later, he comes out of the crowd. I see him and I said, what's up, man? You okay? And he comes up, he just sprayed me, goes into my bag, and there just happened to be a camera there. I'm thinking he's just getting a bottle of water. I could tell he was pissed, and a lot of people were pissed. So this isn't like to put him down or to, you know, everybody. There was women, children, handicapped, Asians, Spanish, Black people. Everybody was pissed that the cops were, because a lot of us were just walking up. Then he goes into my bag. There just happened to be a camera there, and he give me that bear shit. He pulls it out, and I'm like, what is going on? And I panic. You know, I'm like, oh, man, no. Hold on, not yet. This isn't, you know. This isn't what this is for. And he's on a, you know, he has never been around that type of stuff before, you know, the spray or whatever. Whereas I have, being in the bar business in the late night scene, you know, officers down here would spray kids like in a heartbeat. So they're the number one party school in the country. So it's like a rite of passage down here. When I took it away from him, I was like, man, that's how this thing really played out in my mind. It was like catastrophe averted. Then months later, I find out that an incident did happen.
It took a month for you to find out that Julian actually used the spray.
No, it took me a week in jail before I found out what happened.
Okay, so it was a week in jail before you found out.
Yeah, he never told me.
Okay, so he hid that information from you on purpose.
I mean, he never told me. Well, when I told him later on that evening, I said, "You owe me 20 years of your life, because if you would have sprayed those cops, you'd be in deep shit." And I probably said that like two more times over the course of like 2 months, just via text, like, you owe me because I saved your ass, because, you know, I know the implications of that.
Right.
And I'm sure they saw the text messages of that to prove that I had no culpability in this, and there was no conspiracy, you know, or aiding and abetting. That was one of the charges.
Sure.
Because I would have, you know, not that I would have turned him in, but yeah, I would have turned him in, because I'm not here to ruin my life. I spent 18 years building a concept. It wasn't just a sandwich shop. It was a concept.
Yeah.
That was very unique. And, you know, three kids, and now I have one on the way. But
so after your denial of bond the second time by Judge Hogan, then your attorneys went to work and managed to get your case in front of the D.C. Appellate Court.
Yeah. One thing I want to point out is when he confessed basically to the FBI, and then I don't know if you saw that article, but there's a video there of his and he tells them George had nothing to do with this. George didn't even want to go to the Capitol. George didn't want to go up there. And he told them on it, and they still ran with the narrative that I was this grand conspirator and this grand planner to go overthrow the government. And when they raided my house, they found two bottles of bear spray, one small can of pepper spray, you know, in my closet, just stuff that I have, you know, along with my my weapons. And they never told the judges that. They never mentioned any of that.
They
just wanted to paint me as this guy, you know, attacked officers. Now, within the first hour of the Capitol event and Officer Sicknick's death, unfortunately, may he rest in peace, they knew he wasn't bludgeoned to death, but that got leaked to the media. So the media ran with this narrative, and they even tried to impeach Trump on this assault on officers, where we hit the guy with the fire extinguisher. So just goes to show you how like the story just kept falling apart for them, but nobody ever tried to correct it. The media never tried to correct it. My attorneys had no opportunity to even mention that in court, to bring that out, like to say, listen, you know, it was all just very like 10 seconds, and very frustrating, to be honest with you.
That little tidbit that you threw in there about the fact that the FBI prosecuting attorneys didn't bother to even inform the judge. Obviously, you didn't know that he had confessed and that he had said those things. Attorneys didn't know it. And this is happening in case after case after case of January 6th defendants. And again, I've said this 1,000 times, and I'm going to beat this horse, because this is the most important thing that America needs to know about this, is that the Department of Justice has no interest in justice whatsoever. They are interested only in notches on their gun belt. We know that the FBI, they get bonuses to their
pay. Yeah.
we that's coming out in whistleblower confessions. We know that the FBI agents themselves are getting bonuses in their pay for the number of arrests that they're making and seeing those arrests through to completion. We know that this is probably also happening within the Department of Justice with the lawyers. Certainly it is that those numbers of aggregated notches in their gun belts and convictions are going towards their promotions, going towards, you know, higher office if they so seek that thing. And this is happening in every single case.
I want to go on the record with this. During the incident, or when this stuff was happening, there was a gentleman standing next to me, and I called him out. I said, "Are you a Fed? Are you undercover right now?" Because I was talking to this guy, and he's sitting there before Julian came out, because my cousin used to work for the Feds, and I have been on protests with him when he had his team investigating protests like this. This is after 9/11. And may he rest in peace. He died of cancer. But I called this guy out, and he's just like, got quiet, and he put his goggles on. And I kept telling my attorneys, I'm like, there was no way they know I didn't use this spray, because the guy standing right next to me, he saw, I mean, for them to paint, to find out where I was, because that's how far removed I was from the incident. You know, it wasn't a crapshoot. It wasn't a needle in the haystack. There had to have been someone there to say, look, this guy was this guy, and this guy tied it all together. And they knew the facts of the case, but they never once put the truth out. They just put out this false narrative to get me and to paint it as a certain event, ultimately to get Donald Trump. which is
ultimately this is again, it's the same thing that has happened in so many cases. And I can tell you, as somebody that sat every single day in the Oath Keepers trial for 9 weeks, I can tell you that for whatever those individual five defendants in that case might have been guilty of, what they were not guilty of was what they were convicted for.
I know.
And that is those gentlemen.
You know, Megs, man, I can't tell you, like, these guys are like the greatest guys.
Yeah, you spent time, you were in jail with them.
It's very disheartening what's happening to them.
Yeah, I know. And the passion that I have right now comes from Ken Harrelson's case, and I'm sure you know Ken. And the passion that I have was, and this actually happened to me, George. I was, you know, certainly interested in all things related to January 6th because I was there. And then my threatened prosecution happened in November of 21. And then, as a result of working directly with Ken's attorney, Brad Geyer, I looked up Ken's case file and I started looking at his criminal charge, his complaints. And I found a minimum of six or seven flat out lies that just jumped off the page to me that were manufactured, that were completely contrary to the video evidence against him. The video, and in fact, when I say the video evidence against him, that's a misstatement, because the video evidence was exculpatory. It proved his innocence of what he was being charged with. And yet they managed to somehow twist that evidence, turn it 180 degrees on its head, and then charge him as being, quote unquote, the tip of the spear, the leader of the insurrection. And he's the most innocent of all those guys.
What's funny is when we would all go to court and we're all in jail together, you know, so whenever somebody had a bond hearing and come back like, bad news guys or whatever, you know, they call me the tip of the spear. And then Dominic would say, I'm the tip of the spear. And then this guy would say, I'm the tip of the spear. So we're all tips of the spears of this grand conspiracy to overthrow our government when nobody had that intention, you know. And, you know, what government are you going to overthrow? You're just going to go in there and make somebody president and say, okay, you're going to run California, you're going to run Alaska, you're going to run Texas from D.C.? Like, just makes no sense. And, you know, to say that it was bigger than 9-11, I grew up in New Jersey. I've been to the Twin Towers. I know people that died in 9-11. My business partner, his father died in 9-11. And they painted us as terrorists. It's very frustrating.
Well, you're Lebanese, right?
I'm Lebanese Christian.
First generation. Yeah.
So for 2 years, we have to stay silent. And I'm probably supposed to stay silent now, but because of my civil case. Now I'm being sued for $10 million. And within that, sorry, I'm crying. I'm a little upset because you know the story.
Oh, yeah.
You know what's happening to all these guys. So it's a little frustrating. But now I'm being sued for $10 million. For this wrongful death, and the attorney's like, listen, typically we tell people to stay quiet because it doesn't help your case. They can use every word against you, this and that. There's nothing to use against me.
Your words, your case, it's already on the record.
No
problem with the emotionalism, man.
I'm sorry, man. I haven't cried about this in a while.
No, you're all right. But let's do this, because I want to, and I know we're jumping around a little bit, which is totally cool, but chronologically, you now have this appellate ruling in your favor. Yeah. So DC appellate court ruled 3-0 in your favor. This hasn't happened that I know of in any of these other cases. And as a result of that, they basically, as I said before, they bitch slapped Judge Hogan and said that he violated your rights in the denial of that bond hearing. And they had the case law to back themselves up. I mean, they are an appellate court. And then you were immediately released, right?
Like 2 weeks after,
by the processing. Yeah.
The day before my 40th birthday.
All right. Now, you're immediately released, but your charges have not been dropped. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. So they send you home. You're on home detention. You're not even allowed, because you're wearing an ankle bracelet. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you're not even allowed to go out on your own porch or deck.
Yeah, for 3 months.
So you have to sit inside your place, inside your house. You can't even go on your deck during this period. That finally was eventually mitigated into a curfew arrangement, so you could go handle some of your business operations and take care of things.
This whole time, my restaurant was shuttered. We're paying rent for the location. You know, I had this plan of coming out and reopening, but it was just no way. I mean, there's no way. I didn't realize I was going to be on curve. I didn't realize it was going to take that long, but I finally got a chance to speak to say, you know, why I needed time to get out of the house. And I quickly said, I'm innocent of all these charges. And the judge is like, oh, well, hold on. We're not here to discuss that. I said, I'm here to discuss it. I haven't had a chance to say a word yet in 5 months, 6 months. At that point, it was like 9 months. And I'm innocent of all these charges. You guys got me cooped up in my house. I lost my business. I have three kids. I like let it rip. And everyone's eyes just perked up. And, you know, this is all via Zoom. And my attorneys were like, oh, shit, George's going off. I was like, I need to get out of this house, take care of my business. I'm paying rent. I have $15,000 worth of food. Like, it was like the opening week where students were coming back.
Yeah.
The week I got arrested. So we're buying all this food and this premium stuff. So I finally, he said, okay, we're going to curfew it. And I think he, after the quote unquote, you're saying it, bitch slack, you know, of letting me out the appellate court, he said, okay, we're going to give you curfew. So I was on curfew for a year and a half after that.
Yeah.
And the charges were still there. So one thing led to another. I got one plea agreement, a second plea agreement. And I kept telling my attorneys, I'm not pleading into a parking ticket.
Now let's talk about the plea agreements real quick, because this was a progression itself. I think when I pre-interviewed you for this podcast, I think you told me that the first thing that they offered you was a 6-year prison term as a plea agreement, as opposed to 60 years in prison. Right?
Yeah.
So that sounds pretty good, right? But you said, no way. I'm not going to plea to something that I did not do.
Right.
And then what was their second offer?
I don't even think she really mentioned it. She was like, they got another plea offer. I told them it wasn't happening. So we're not going to let you plead to anything, because they knew the facts of the case. They knew how it was being portrayed. I told them multiple times, I'm not pleading no parking ticket, because I didn't even drive that day, you know? So I'm not taking something that I didn't do. And I was prepared, and they were preparing to go to trial.
Yeah.
We added two more attorneys, one from DC, one from Eastern Panhandle, all these specialists. They got a carte blanche from the boss over here to represent my case.
Wow.
You guys need, because they knew people that knew me. They knew I was a business owner. They knew I wasn't somebody that's going here. They could tell what was happening to me was an injustice.
Right. That's why I say you got a good one, and you know, thank God for that in your case. And so many people we've heard about did not get a good one. Just wanted it to, you know, let's get this thing in and out over with, and take your plea deal and take your knocks and go.
Well, you know, as time progressed, after like the third plea denial, my attorney showed up to my house and said, listen, they dropping all the charges. They want to supersede the indictment and give you two misdemeanors. You know, they won't let Julian take a plea deal if you don't take one. So they were tying us together.
Okay.
And it was both of us going to trial, or we were both taking a plea deal. I mean, that's what they were putting in front of us. And my attorneys are like, look, this two misdemeanors, $500 fine, time served, it's over. It was gut-wrenching to even sign that paperwork.
Now how long before that deal was presented from the beginning? So from
about a year and a half.
It took a year and a half that you had 10 felony charges hanging over your head.
Yeah.
Year and a half later, despite
the media running with this narrative that we sprayed him with bear spray this whole time. Right. It's a deadly insurrection. An officer died that day. You know, it's been unique.
So obviously they come to you and now they say two misdemeanors, time served, $500 fine. It's basically over.
It took them 3 hours to convince me to even think about signing my name on that paper.
Wow.
Because the way they had portrayed me, I wanted the facts to come out. And I knew that this was going to be a way to just shut the door on the case.
Yeah.
Okay. And I wasn't happy with that, but I ended up taking the plea deal to help Julian out and to save grace on my wife here, because she's like, listen, we got to get this over with. you know, I have three kids. I have another one on the way now. And my family, you know, living on eggshells for the past 2 years, you know, year and a half at the time. But it was gut-wrenching. And throughout the period between August, like that mid-July, to sentencing, there was, I can't, maybe a dozen times where I wanted to take back the plea deal from different signs that I was getting from more information coming out, the judge pushing the case back multiple times, to the judge trying to retire within 2 weeks. He basically gave us 2 weeks notice, and he's out the office. Mm. And my attorneys, he dropped that bombshell on us the first week of January, and they're like, holy cow, like, we don't want another judge. It's like they were trying to keep this. Mm. They wanted to keep it going. Because the longer they could keep running with this narrative and keep us silent, the longer they could run with the narrative that it was a deadly insurrection, and it wasn't. Yeah. I was nowhere near the officer. He unfortunately died of natural causes, and they still lie about it. It's very frustrating. But
all right, so let's go back to the legal issues, because it wasn't over when you signed that agreement, because now you've signed your plea deal, and you have now a scheduled sentencing date. So this is the real deal. This is where it really is technically supposed to be all said and done.
Yeah.
So your sentencing date is given to you, and that was late January of this year, right? 23.
Well, it was supposed to be November 1st, and then or November that first month, and then it got pushed back to December, and then it got pushed back to January. So all these time, you know, I just kept thinking, like, this is a sign. I need to take this to trial. I need to take this to trial, because I felt like I would win in D.C. with my case, especially with the 10 felons. Now, the two misdemeanors, the trespassing, you know, if I was on the grass, I'm considered trespassing. You know, they were going to get me on that, send me back for another 6 months. But I was willing to take that risk, too. But I finally got my sentencing date, January 27th. Mm-hmm. Went to court. We decided to do it in person. The judge actually said that we don't even need to go to D.C. We could do it via Zoom. So, like, in my mind, like I was saying, this is like a movie to me. It's just like, you know, they accuse me of doing this major crime, all in to go down to a parking, you know, to basically two misdemeanors. And I have friends telling me, oh, misdemeanors. You know, one friend that I was in there with, he's like, we eat misdemeanors for breakfast. And I'm like, this is crazy. I've never been in trouble before. And then I don't even need to go to D.C. And I'm like, man, this is crazy. So I'm going to get time served. My attorneys decided to go to D.C., show face. We go down there, better safe than not do it. So
was Julian in the same sentencing hearing?
Yeah, he was.
Same time. And it was not a good day for him.
He ended up getting 80 months.
80 months. Was that a plea agreement?
That was his plea agreement. Yeah, they dropped all the charges except for two assaults. Mm-hmm. And he got 80 months. The night before, we find out that the Capitol Police were showing up there in support of the Sicknick family.
And the Sicknick family themselves.
The Sicknick family showed up. So, you know, within 3 days of the hearing, we find out that they're going to make impact statements.
Right.
And, you know, again, that was another sign of me saying, I'm not going to trial. I'm not going to court. I want to take it back to trial, because they basically said on paper that I killed their son. And I didn't do that. And, you know, I'm really sorry for their loss, but for them to perpetuate this lie, they know it's a lie. They have to know it's a lie. They're out there, basically come up there and tell us that we killed their son and we're cop killers and we deserve to rot in jail and all this for an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, I think it came out to be, at the hearing. Now, Julian told his father not to go. His father and his brothers were going to go. He actually told them, and I'm looking to see if they're in the crowd. They weren't there, and it turned out he told them not to come because they weren't going to tolerate. I mean, they were. Who knows what they would have done hearing that. The way they portrayed us is a complete lie.
So in addition to the Sicknick family being there in the courtroom for your sentencing, and also the arrival of Capitol Police, it was quite a large number of them. Was it like 60 or so?
60, 70, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they were all giving me the...
Including the celebrity Capitol Police officers like Harry Dunn and Gunnell, is that right?
Yeah, they were there. It's strange seeing them in person, you know, because, you know, you see them on TV and you see them talking this and that. They honestly, I felt like I was in the courtroom with a bunch of demons, to be honest. I don't think I've ever told anybody that, but it was such a weird feeling, like knowing these people were in there and they know it was a lie. They had to know what they're calling us and what they're accusing us of, or they were, you know, here's the kickers. After they spoke, the judge said the elephant in the room is Officer Brian Sicknick's death, but these men aren't being charged with that. So I can't rule on that because they weren't charged with it.
The judge actually said that. Was this Judge Hogan?
This was Judge Hogan. It was like the 2 seconds I was like, man, this guy's great guy. Like, thank you for saying something true here. Like, you know, like.
Finally.
And it was like, it took the air out of the room almost.
Well, thank God you have that on the official court record.
Yeah.
Going forward because of what you're now facing, because here's the, you know, here's the other punchline. Just when you think it's all said and done. And by the way, you ended up having your final sentencing was amended somewhat. They raised your fine from
$1,800 because I had a gift send go set up where people were donating to help my family out. And it only raised like $1,500 because we need help. I mean, I lost everything and it's been a challenge.
We're going to put that give send go here in the comments or below wherever this is posted. But the other thing is that in addition to raising your fine, didn't they add probation to that as well?
Yeah, they added 1 year probation, and that wasn't part of the agreement.
It was not.
That was another sign to say, I'm not going. Mm. I'm not going into that room. And then when all the cops showed up, you know, when all the officers showed up, I'm not going in that room. They're trying to paint me out. Like, it was almost there to, like, to intimidate the judge.
Yeah.
They weren't intimidating me. Now, I know where I stand. I know where my moral ground stands and what my facts are. And even Julian, you know. But they all showed up there to paint this picture, even, you know, and all those wonderful journalists from the D.C., the tool bags, we'll call them, because they're government tools. They're out there running this narrative that it's a deadly insurrection, this and that. And so they all ran with, Capitol Police show up and this and that.
Were you interviewed by any mainstream press agents, like from nobody from Washington Post, New York Times, NBC?
I was interviewed on the way out of jail, my first when I got out for bond, and Eric Flack the Hack from D.C. came up to me and with a microphone. I don't know if you've seen this video, but I'll send it to you. Maybe you can share it in the link. Mm. He comes up to me with a microphone after I got out of jail, and everyone inside were like, what are you going to say when you get out? Because I was the first one to get out in quite some time, and I was almost the second to last. There was two more that got out after me. I said, I don't know what I'm going to say. They're like, sing the national anthem. This is the only interview I've had with the DC media. Sing the national anthem or just speak in Arabic. And I'm like, I'm gonna say Corn Pop was a bad dude. They're like, like, no, you're not. I walked out and Eric Flack puts the microphone in my face. He's like, sir, give me. I said, yeah, Joe Biden is doing an excellent job. And it was the week of Afghanistan, the withdrawal. He said, What did you say? And I could feel his energy saying, oh my God, he felt like he was a conduit between me and the president, and you know, this all, you know, inspiring moment here with the microphone. I said, yeah, Joe Biden is doing a great job. He's like, what? He didn't know how to take it. I said, yeah, Corn Pop was a bad dude. And he's like, Corn Pop? Who's Corn Pop?
Oh my gosh.
God bless you, man. I got in the car and left. And that was the only interview I've done with.
Isn't that interesting that they have no interest in your case at all because of you? I mean, let's be honest, George, with all of the tragedy, the travesties of justice that we've seen and witnessed throughout this process, you do have, in fact, a victorious story to tell. And I'm sure you're thankful for that. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you know, certainly sorry for what you had to go through to get to that final victory. But as we've already pointed out, it's still not over. So was it before your sentencing hearing that you received notice? And this is just mind blowing. There is a civil suit for wrongful death being brought by the Sicknick family. There are only three named defendants in this suit.
Unbelievable.
It's yourself. It's Julian. And former President Donald Trump, each one of you being sued for $10 million apiece in his death. But we have, as you articulated already, the statement from Judge Hogan saying that we're not here to sentence these guys based on the death of Brian Sicknick.
Yeah. And Sandra Garza came out the Monday after and did an interview saying that she agreed with my sentencing. You know, it's like a movie, you know, it's like the Twilight Zone. I never in a million years thought I'd be on a civil suit with Donald Trump himself. Like, man, this is, I hope he's not these morons down there, you know, attacking cop, you know, he knows the facts of the case. I would hope he does because of the severity of it. But the way it just goes to show you, like, if they're trying to tie us into this and trying to tie him. So it's a 47-page civil suit that's literally all about him and about the election fraud and how he told us all to go there. And they're trying to say that he subconsciously got into my mind to go there that day and overthrow the government. Come on. This is crazy. This is crazy. Now, you mentioned earlier that the judge that's on the case is no fan of Donald Trump. He's probably no fan of me now, and it could possibly be retribution.
Well, this is the final punchline, I think, in your case. When I say the final, God only knows where it's going to go. I'm fairly confident that because Donald Trump is one of the named defendants, that this particular case will not see a courtroom for, you know, years, probably 2 or 3 years or at the very least before it ever shows up. But the judge on the case is the J6 hanging judge, Judge Amit Mehta.
Unbelievable. And you've been in a room with him, right? Oh, you've been in the courtroom. So, you know, his demeanor, you know what he's, you know, capable of. I don't know. It's just such a sad situation. Like, I don't. And, you know, the crazy thing is, I'm pretty sure that me and Officer Brian Sicknick were born in the same hospital. We grew up in the same area. We're in the same county. Julian was born in New Jersey, too, like in the same area, possibly in the same hospital as well. So, like, you know, we don't have any ill will toward Capitol Police. I mean, at the time, now we, you know, we're a little pissed because they're hiding a lot of evidence. They're not speaking out. Where are the good guys at? Yeah. Apparently, there's contract agreements that they have to sign. They can't speak up on these types of things. You know, is that what this country's turned into? You know,
well,
where,
you know, there are some good guys, as you know, coming forward.
Right. I've been following your reporting.
Yeah. And I have not only been able to make, you know, assist in making one of those guys public. And he has now done, he's doing the media tour now as well.
He's a legend, man. God bless him, man. I don't know if he was a Trump supporter before then, but I know when he put that red hat on, because I've seen the videos, he was treated completely different, because it's not about skin color. It's not about blue, red, white, green. It's about being an American, and we want to see our country do better in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, well, that we're talking about Lieutenant Tarik Johnson, and he is the guy who famously put on the red MAGA hat in order to rescue 16 officers that had been trapped and were actually radioing in that they were fearful for their life or from where they were at. And he then not only put on this red MAGA hat, which allowed him to pass through the crowd much easier, as you can imagine. Right. But he also recruited 2 Oath Keepers to assist him in that rescue. And all of that was suppressed evidence by Judge Mehta in the courtroom. He would not allow that entire event to be presented before the jury in that the first Oath Keepers trial. It's an amazing thing. And so after, you know, 2 years of frustration from Lieutenant Johnson on his behalf, he decided to come forward. He spoke with myself and Joe Hanneman from the Epoch Times. And then we've been able to get his story out to, you know, the national media all the way up to, you know, Tucker Carlson and beyond now. But the other thing that's happening is now, because of that work and the stories that I've written on that, I have unnamed Capitol Police officers who are contacting me directly, privately. These are guys that are still in the force and they're talking. And we're getting more information about the day from these guys, because they are just as frustrated with what happened that day as you are. And although they didn't have to spend 5.5 months in a jail cell or 2 years behind prison bars during their process, they have been silenced. They obviously, you know, some of the guys that are talking to me, because they still work for the force, they're afraid to talk publicly for obvious reasons. They've got to feed their families. They've got their paycheck to worry about. They've got their pensions on the line. All of these things, because they've seen it happening, and they know that if they come forward, then they become a target. And that is a real, you know, a lot of people get mad at them, say, well, they're not real patriots. They're not, you know, if they really were good guys, they'd come in. You know, life has mitigating circumstances that we have to navigate. And you've got wife and children at home, and you're 2 years before your retirement, you know, you qualify for your pension. Those kind of things do mitigate your decisions. And I understand that, but at least they're talking and they're assisting us. And we're able, because they are talking to us, we're able to bring specific incidences about specific defendants, that they're guys being charged with crimes where these officers were present, and they're going, no, I don't think that happened like that. Mm-hmm. And so we're getting some help now, even from the inside.
On the other end, you got Teletubby Officer Dunn over there, you know, and the reason why I call him Teletubby is because I know the facts of the case, and I was in jail with the men that were standing there in front of him, right, protecting him from the crowd. You know, I mean, that's why it's so disheartening, because when you get called a liar, you get called a terrorist, you get called all this shit, and you got the media out there running this narrative, and you know, you're just, you know, you were there as a patriotic American, and you're thrown in jail.
Yeah.
Based on what this guy might be lying about.
Well, I can tell you right now that one of the biggest fears that the leadership at the Capitol Police have, the biggest fears of the people who have been able to establish and preserve this narrative about January 6th, that one of those biggest fears they have regarding the access to all of that video is Harry Dunn's story, because it's going to fall apart if that video is ever released.
Anybody who knows the case knows he's full of shit. It's very funny. He was at my trial. He sat there during the break in the back of the room. I can't tell you how many, you know, what I wanted to say to him and the other officers, and they know it's bullshit. And that's a crime in itself, because you're accusing me of something, trying to throw me in jail, trying to throw these other guys in jail based on a lie. There needs to be consequences for that.
Well, I'm going to tell you something else, and I'll go public with this right now. 90%, maybe over 90% of his fellow officers also know that Dunn's story is bullshit.
Yeah, 100%.
That's where we're at.
He said he was called the N-word 15 times and all that, with the lady with the pink cat. Where is she? Where's the footage?
Yeah.
Where's that footage? You think they can't run with that? Where's the footage now? I'm going to go off for a second. when Tucker went up there, and I knew he was going to break the narrative of my situation, they framed me within 12 words, but he vindicated me within 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. Where's the rest of the footage of Officer Brian Sicknick walking around the Capitol, talking to his coworkers? There's multiple coworkers that said he was fine. He texted his family, "I'm okay." They even debunked their own story within their own impact statement.
And we should point out that there appears to be a new presented video evidence that it's quite possible that Sicknick was not actually hit by Julian's spray. In fact, that he was hit by his own officers.
It's like the magic bullet.
He was a victim of friendly fire when it comes to the chemical sprays, although we know that the chemical sprays did not harm him, hurt him, or kill him.
If they were a deadly weapon, and if they caused death, they wouldn't be sold in the aisle in Walmart.
That's right.
That CS spray that the officers are using, even if he was indirectly sprayed, how are they spraying all of us and all the crowd and all the people? I didn't get sprayed, but the crowd, and that's not a deadly weapon. So you can come in and indiscriminately spray old women, grown men, people handicapped in the crowd, but that's okay. But then he gets hit, and now it turned into a deadly weapon, and it's a deadly insurrection. Now, you know, you never know when somebody's going to go. It's up to God when you go and when you come, you know, at the end of the day, whether you get hit by a car or whatever it is, you have a stroke. But to blame us, and in turn, they're turning this into bigger than 9/11. It's just so freaking crazy to me.
Well, I can tell you that I got hit by the OC spray that the police officers were using. And I wasn't targeted, but I was on the west side with my camera videoing what was happening. And I was not targeted because obviously I wasn't doing any violence against anyone. But with my being where I was downwind from all the police line. I was on the south side, and the wind was blowing, you know, 25, 30 miles an hour from the north to the south. And so I caught some of the splash and downwind spray that hit me. And there's nothing pleasant about it, I'll tell you that. There's nothing pleasant about that experience whatsoever. But it's certainly not a deadly weapon. And I as a result of that, finally started working my way more towards the northwest side of the battle line and began filming from there. So I actually then, when I was on the northwest side, I had retreated back into the crowd for a while because I would take a break, you know, and move back in and then reestablish my position, turn the camera back on and do that. And at one point when I was in the crowd, one of those flashbang canisters of some sort was launched over the head of the violent offenders into what I would describe as the where the peaceful protesters were gathered, just observing the event as it was taking place. It landed about 3 feet and exploded about 3 feet from me to my right, and shrapnel hit me, and I carried a bruise on my leg for several months after that. And again, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it actually, as it turned out, it was safer for me to be closer to the battle line and yeah. from there than it was back into the crowd, because particularly those Metropolitan police officers, by, you know, closer you got to 2 o'clock, they were just indiscriminately launching those grenades into the peaceful.
I never heard once an announcement to disperse, you know, or this is an unlawful protest or whatever, nothing, zero.
Now, yeah, that did be ultimately happen, but it was late in the day. They finally brought the speakers out and they started, you know, running that announcement. But again, if you weren't right in front of the speakers because of the crowd noise, because of the wind, there was no way that people just a few feet back were ever going to hear that announcement. I actually was close enough to it at that point. I captured those announcements on my camera. But again, they didn't start till late. It certainly did not have the power to broadcast that out to that entire crowd, and ultimately was completely inefficient anyway. In fact, in those announcements, they were actually warning that they were going to increase the types of weaponry that they were using. They were going to use even more. I have to remember what the word was, but essentially they were going to step it up a notch is what they were going to do, and the types of less lethals that they were going to use.
I want to go on the record. Like, I don't condone assaults on officers. I don't, you know, some people did some crazy shit that day. I didn't go there to disrupt any type of transfer of power. And I would say 99% didn't, but there were some bad actors in the crowd, yep. People trying to push us forward, people wearing the wrong, you know, basically stuff ready to fight. And, so I know how they painted that. And that's where I think you posted a video the other day where, it's funny how all the media was standing up front already and recording, and you had this photographer and that photographer, and Nancy Pelosi had her daughter with their whole TV crew. Like,
well, I mean, they had credentialed press photographers were showing up like war correspondents dressed for battle before Trump ever finished his speech. They were already.
How would they know to do that?
How did they know how to do that? How did they know where to be for this to happen? So there's a lot of unanswered questions, and they're legitimate questions that need to be asked, and nobody's asking the right questions of the right people, and they're certainly not being answered if they are. But I will say this: something that you said a while ago triggered this thought. Yeah, you're right. There were people that lost their minds that day, and otherwise good people that did some bad things. But I've said this from the very beginning. I saw bad people doing bad things. I saw good people doing good things. I saw otherwise good people did some really stupid things. I think probably your friend Julian is one of the ones that falls in that latter category. But when I say bad people doing bad things, good people doing good things, otherwise good people doing stupid things, that's on both sides of that line.
Right. 100%.
That happened on the protester side of the line. It also happened on the law enforcement officer side of the line.
What a lot of people don't understand, I think, and probably your followers do, or people that are really attuned to what's happening, these types of events happen in other countries probably on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
You know, where they want to cause a coup, or, you know, create a coup or an overthrow of a certain local, political group or whatever. There's good actors, bad actors, people there to start these issues so they could start wars or start, you know, problems. And when you know that, you could see, oh, man, this was like one big setup. And this isn't some like small time planning. This is a plan that they've run with in multiple countries, multiple different places. Brazil just happened a couple months ago. Is on a Sunday, there's no security, they're storming the Capitol. Now they throw all these people in jail, you know, 1,500. I'm sure if you're following what happened, they threw all these women, grandmas, all in this one rec room, no water, no food. What are their fellow Brazilians going to think? What are our fellow Americans going to think? You know, Trump asked everyone to go protest on Tuesday, and everyone's like, well, don't fall into this trap. There's confusion there. And now you're afraid to stand up for your beliefs and your constitutional right. And that's the scary part. You know, my parents left the Middle East, Lebanon, because of the civil war. Mm-hmm. And when you were saying, you know, your neighbor turned you in Lebanon, you don't know who's going to turn you in. You don't know who your enemy is. When there's 20, I think there was like 15 or 16 different militias fighting in one city. So you got Christian militias fighting the Druze, the Israelis, the Muslims, the Syrian. You got different factions, and basically everybody takes a building, and you have this building, they have that building. Anybody walks outside, they hit you with a sniper.
Yeah.
For 15 years. What Americans don't understand is we got a little too cushy here, and everyone got too distracted with the sports and the arenas and the concerts and the movies every Friday and all this and all that, while our constitutional right has been eroded for decades now.
Yes. And until America understands, and this is obviously the most difficult process that we're going through right now, and you know it as well as anybody else, is that this country is so divided right now that there are people, despite the fact that you were charged with 10 felonies and got it reduced to two misdemeanors, they think that you need to be in Guantanamo for the rest of your life and being waterboarded daily for that. There are people in this country.
People that know me.
Half of the country thinks that myself as a journalist was there only as a journalist that day, who was not even a Trump supporter, was there to cover the event, was because I was there and because I walked into that building, they have said the same thing. I need to be in a dungeon. I need to be in Guantanamo Bay. I need to be spending the rest of my life in prison. Now, this is the amazing part, though, is then I can say to that person, so Luke Mogelson, the reporter from The New Yorker, who did exactly the same thing that I did that day, does he need to go to Guantanamo as well? It's
the twilight zone, man.
Yeah, we're that irrationally divided right now. But more importantly, and I open with this theme, I will close with this theme, and that is this: the Department of Justice in this country, the DOJ, is the heart, soul, core of the Death Star that is attacking Americans' civil liberties, violating their constitutional rights right now. They don't care about justice. They are agenda driven. And the other thing that even our side doesn't understand, and I'm so frustrated with the Republicans, I'm so frustrated with these new committees, I'm so frustrated with even the right-wing press, the big bullhorns on the right side, because they have failed to cover January 6th properly. They've failed to come to our defense. And the reason why they fail is that the narrative was won that day. Nancy Pelosi won her victory. She won her narrative that day. And it doesn't matter. I'm not going into conspiracy theory at all. I'm not saying she started it. I'm not saying she planned it. I'm saying that because it happened and in the way it developed, that nevertheless, they won a victory because 300 people did bad things that day out of 500,000 that were there. They won this massive narrative victory. And as a result of that, the Department of Justice has been able to run roughshod over individual American civil liberties beyond the 300 bad guys, and now are extending that out. They've arrested 1,000 already. They've already said they're going to do 700 to 1,200 more. We actually believe that they're looking at about 2,000 other faces that they're going to pull into this dragnet, and there's going to be more individuals treated just like you were treated in the process, where the facts of the case don't matter. They're going to withhold evidence. The FBI is going to manipulate and massage evidence and present in their complaints to the Justice Department things that didn't even happen, didn't even take place, to ruin people's lives. And the ultimate purpose of that is to scare half the country from even opening their voices in protest against the government, which is our constitutional right to do.
It's a scary time right now, man. Like, I never in a million years thought that I'd be in this position, this country be in this position? Where did this all? I don't even know how we got to this point, but you know, Donald Trump came in. I'm a fan. I'm a voter. I'm a supporter of his. But it really, and I told Julie Kelly this. She asked me, "Why'd you go?" Whatever. I said, "It's not about Donald Trump. It's not about him at all. It's about the voice of the people. If we're the majority, which I believe we were, we voted for this one particular individual. Whether we voted for someone else or whatever, whoever we voted for, that there's an issue there. There's multiple questions that need to be brought up, and they weren't being brought up properly. They keep saying they're brought up in the courts, this and that, but just the way the DOJ and the department, you know, the FBI has been infiltrated by people that want to run their own agenda. These aren't elected individuals. Neither were these judges in these all different states. There's corruption from the bottom, from the parking attendant, all the way to the top. Right now in the state of West Virginia, the WVU, West Virginia state troopers are in trouble. There's corruption across the board.
Yeah.
I grew up in New Jersey. I almost became a police officer myself, and I knew the bad cops and I knew the good cops. I knew cops that were drug dealing. My DARE instructor had 2 prostitution rings. You know, there's corruption everywhere. And when you go into the Middle East or other countries, 10 times worse. Mexico, they already know. But here in America, when you say, oh, these politicians are corrupt and these judges are corrupt, Banana Republic or, you know, Kangaroo Court, they think you're just making it up. You're a tinfoil hat and you're crazy.
Yeah.
People need to wake up. People need to understand that this country didn't invent electricity, modern everything pretty much that the world has been feasting off of by having tyranny on us. You know, this isn't a communist country. I mean, it's become that now because of what you're seeing. And, you know, you're a constitutionalist. You know, like you said, you weren't a Trump supporter. Hopefully people are waking up, man. I mean, I think a lot of people are. They see what's happening. That's why the ratings are so low. Nobody's watching these shitty ass TV channels. Nobody's watching Fox News. You know, it blew up there. Oh, Fox News is full of shit. CNN's full of shit. Newsmax is full of shit. How come they haven't called me to see what my story is?
Yeah.
Because I'm going to break the narrative. You know, so now I'm turning to guys like you that are, we are the media, the people, Twitter. I appreciate what Elon's doing, but I mean, you don't know what his agenda is. These guys all have agendas.
Yeah.
And there is an agenda here. And the main agenda is to shut us up. To make us all scared. The left can go out and riot. This past week proved that. You know, Trump called for us to protest. Everyone's like, oh, he's calling for another insurrection. But the left, they can go out and protest for weeks and months. You know, I was at a BLM event myself. I was on the front page of the local paper. I have a lot of black friends, grew up, employees from all walks of life. I have no animosity to anyone. I'm not a racist. But now suddenly, because I was there at January 6th, I've turned into a Nazi. I'm a racist. I don't, you know, what the heck? How come they don't show... You know, looking at the footage of Discovery, the one office was there. There was a huge gay flag, you know, the rainbow flag right there next to the Trump flag. How come I've never seen that? I was in jail with Jessica Watkins. You know Jessica?
Oh, yeah.
She's transgender. How come they don't talk about her? They never came out. The ACLU never came out to help her.
Right.
They never mentioned her. She loves this country. She went to war for this country.
Mm-hmm.
And now she, you know. So exactly. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak here. I've been following you forever, and it's been great. Thank you for the footage, for sure, for the updates, especially with the Oath Keeper stuff.
But. Yeah, man. Well, look, George, thank you as well. The other night, Tucker apologized to me on behalf of the country for what I've gone through, and I've gone through a fraction of what you've been subjected to. You've gone through a half of what guys like Kenny and Megs have gone through, you know, from the top to the bottom, especially when I'm talking about innocent people, what the Department of Justice and what our country is subjected to. I say the same thing, and I echo what Tucker said to me, that on behalf of our country, you know, I apologize for what you're going through, but know this, that some of us are going to go down fighting for the
American
experiment. Yeah, we will.
And I will too, and that's why I'm speaking up.
And that's and I appreciate that. And I'm going to continue as well. And I'm going to, as I said, I don't know exactly how I'm going to package this. I'm certainly going to write an article along with it. I'm going to get this out to some people that I think can help. Your story, I think, is as significant as any January 6th story, as I have heard. And the nation needs to know about it, and we're going to get out to as many as we can, one at a time if we have to.
I appreciate that. I mean, that's the best we can do. I mean, the silence is killing me, and it's killing the whole country, basically, you know. And I never thought that this, you know, never in a million years I thought I'd be in this position.
Well, I'm going to include the,
you know,
I'm going to include some video links. I'm going to include your Giveson Go link in here. And just one quick, just in closing, have you been able to get back to business and reestablish your businesses yet?
No.
Are you going to?
It's like a blessing and a curse. You know, I feel like my life has always been a blessing and a curse because I've always had a great product. I always worked my tail off for my customers. And I never had a problem with customers coming in, buying my product, whatever it was, across my businesses. But you overwork yourself. And I was overworking myself way too much for years. No time with my family,
right.
Not seeing my girl, not seeing my kid. So then they take it all away from me. Now I'm home with my kids. I started a new little business. So, and you know, the food cost right now through the roof.
Right.
Labor is
right.
a huge issue. You know, and my sandwiches weren't cheap already.
Right.
They were 50, like literally $12 to $15. So with the food cost now, they probably at $17 to $20.
Mm-hmm.
And people pay for it because you're getting what you're paying for. But maybe down the road, I might reopen something. You know, I was actually going to sell this restaurant.
Hopefully you're still making those sandwiches at home, because my next time in Morgantown, I'm coming by and we're going to have dinner.
I'll do that for you for sure. But I was in the process of selling the restaurant here that summer.
Wow.
So I had lined it up. We were planning on moving to California to open another place. You know, I almost made it on Shark Tank for my concept. My copycats made it on there. Got a deal with Mark Cuban. You know, this wasn't just some random like sandwich shop. This is it was an institution here in town, but I was creating something unique. But with COVID, you know, a lot of things changed quickly. So I was adapting the business and I thought I was doing pretty well, but you know, just goes to show you how life can take a turn, you know, and you really can't get down on yourself. You know, to the other January 6ers that might see this, you know, God put us all in this position for a reason. He put you in your position. He put the January 6ers in a position. Me, everyone in their own spot for a reason. And you can't let that put you down. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You have to keep fighting for another day.
Yeah.
You know, and if you wake up, God bless you in another day. You can't put yourself down in the dumps. You know, rest in peace, Matthew Perna. I'm pretty sure he ate at my restaurant in State College because he went up there. I used to have a place up there. And I was really distraught by that, what that had happened, because when you have the weight of the government on you and you've never been in jail and your whole life's being flipped upside down, there's a lot of people that are destroyed by it. If they did something wrong, fine. They need to be held accountable, but there needs to be due process, just like everywhere else. And there is no due process in this matter where, like, you know, if you got out on bond, you get to go home, you take care of your situation, you take care of your business end, you tie up some loose ends and you go back to jail. Okay, you did something wrong. That's fine. But you got families being destroyed by this. Children not seeing their parents, their father. You got Meg's, his wife, in jail. They turned him into this huge, and he used to bring me my food trays. You know, every day he'd bring me my food tray. How you doing, sandwich Nazi? I'm doing okay. You know, I'm going to pray for this country. I hope everybody else does. It's definitely, everybody says battle good and evil. 100%. Something nefarious is going on. And you see the country, the world falling apart. People need to wake the hell up, man. This is some crazy shit. And nothing's being done. These elections have been rigged for decades now. Just to say that it was Trump's election or the election before, they've been rigging these elections for decades across the world. You go to talk to Canadians. Sorry, I'm going to talk for a second. Talk to Canadians. They go, we never voted for Trudeau. We never voted for Trudeau. What the heck? Then you hear about in Cuba, Castro. Oh, he 100% of the election. Well, come on. You think 100% of the people in Iran, 100% turnout. Saddam Hussein, 98% turnout. Well, in other countries, they go, you vote for the right guy or you're taking a bullet. Love it or leave it. In Lebanon right now, my countrymen, the worst economic situation in 500, 600 years the world over. Complete collapse of the economy. And people are voting. You know, they let you vote if you're a Christian citizen, or they let you go to Lebanon and vote, or vote overseas. Well, why are you voting if you're overseas and you're not living in the country and you're not being represented in that country? Well, what kind of farce is that? It's all there to bullshit the people, to believe that there's something going on there. And meanwhile, people don't even have a pot to piss in. So people really need to wake up. We need to get back to like reality here and understand that these politicians aren't here to save us. They worked for us, but they're voting themselves in. They're putting themselves into play. So all these politicians out there, I'm calling them out. They're out there saying, oh, free the J6ers, free this, free that. Just release the footage. Let the people see what happened that day. Who's guilty? Who's not? Due process it. Okay. And see, why did that happen that day? What was the alternative agenda? then maybe we'll understand, okay, the election was stolen. You know, I asked my attorney, I said, is the judge going to ask me if the election was stolen? They're like, oh, he might. I'm like, if he does, they better cut the mic because I'm going to let him know. Something right. nefarious happened there. And it wasn't about Trump. It's the will of the people, you know. And I'm going to pray for this country. I hope their followers do. Whether you believe in God or don't, just we want to be better citizens for each other. You know, God bless everybody. I appreciate the time here.
Yeah, man. George, hey, thank you. And we will be in touch. And of course, I'll be following the rest of your story all the way through. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, more to come for sure. More to come.
All right. Hey, man. Thanks a bunch. I really appreciate it.